This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to New York, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference. You can listen to the People Speak live on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 8 to 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time or by going to our site at www.thepeoplespeakradio.net. There you can also listen to our live shows or to past shows on our iPod Ready Archives section. That's thepeoplespeakradio.net. Now, if you have a Nokia phone, you can also listen to us live via satellite. Just go to the website for details. Our toll-free number internationally is 877-489-6350. And in the U.S. and Canada, we have 888-228-4494. We'll repeat that for you during the show. And I'm thrilled and honored to have with us the founder of the Electronic Intifada and journalist, Ali Abu Nameh. Ali is a writer and commentator in the Middle East and Arab American affairs. He lives and teaches in Chicago. His articles have appeared in the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Financial Times, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Jordan Times, Lebanon's Daily Star, and Haaretz, among many others. Welcome to the show, Ali. How are you? And thank you. This is the second time the last time we caught you in a giant snowstorm on your way to Michigan City.
Yes, this time I'm in one place, and here I am, ready to go.
Well, we have a lot of questions for you, Ali. There's a lot happening in the Middle East and in Palestine. First of all, before we start, though, I really would like to get a little bit of background on the Electronic Intifada. The Electronic Intifada, for those of you that don't know, is an incredible and voluminous website that Ali, the founder of, has offered his contributions, gathers and collects the most accurate and pertinent information. It is certainly unbiased and fair. It is considered one of the more credible sites for any kind of information that you would need to gather on the Palestine-Israeli issue. How did you start the Electronic Intifada, Ali?
Well, I'm one of the co-founders, and there were four of us at the start, and we had, it's hard to believe that we've been going now for almost 8 years, and we started off really not knowing at the time that we were pioneering what is now called new media, grassroots, with very little resources, and using the internet to tell the stories and to have the kind of analysis and discussions that were systematically excluded from the mainstream. You know, in the past, you needed to have a multi-million or multi-billion dollar TV station or printing press. And so we were part of the first generation that said, wait a minute, we can do this ourselves. And so it's been an incredible journey, and we're thrilled that we have great contributors just over the past few weeks. We have done, I'm proud to say, some of the best reporting on what was going on in Gaza out there in the English language. And, you know, most of our reports are being written by people in Gaza who are actually living through the situation. And we were able to do something that the mainstream media weren't able to do because they were not in Gaza. They, you know, didn't bother to invest the time and the effort to create the networks, to nurture the independent journalists there, and we did that. So we were amazed that, first of all, by how many people were coming to read the stories, look at the pictures, and hear the voices of people in Gaza. But also mainstream media were coming to us and saying, you know, who can we talk to find out what's going on in Gaza? So it's really been an amazing journey, and we're certainly going to continue it. As long as there's a need, we'll be here to do it. And we're entirely independent. We're funded almost entirely by contributions from individuals. And so that's also very satisfying, that we can be independent without having to worry that we're going to offend this or that funder, and we can say what needs to be said.
Let me ask you, Ali, in light of the information that you have received right from the people of Gaza, from the journalists that are in the territory there, can you give us a rounded impression of how the people of Gaza are feeling in the aftermath? And it really isn't an aftermath. Because,
it's ongoing. It's ongoing.
Yes, it is absolutely ongoing. Israel has never abided by the ceasefire. Many, many Palestinians have died since the very day that they initiated the peace, or they said they initiated the peace, the ceasefire. Can you tell us what you're hearing from Gaza? What are the details that somebody here in this country is not, in America, is certainly not going to hear?
Well, I'm going to preface my remarks by saying that I honestly don't think I can do justice to what people are experiencing there. We have nothing at all to compare it to. It's just the enormity of what has happened where, something like 20% of people in Gaza know somebody who was directly injured in the Israeli attacks. And 15% know someone who was killed. If you were to scale it up in American terms, it's like something like 100,000 Americans being killed in the space of a few weeks' time. And we had a really powerful article that we published by a professor, a literature professor in Gaza. His name is Haider Eid, and the article is called Gaza, Sharpeville 1960, Gaza 2009. And he writes in that, he says, what can one say to comfort a man who has the harrowing task of having to bury his entire family, including his wife, his sons, his daughters, and his grandchildren? Tell us, and we will relay your words to Uncle Subhi, because his loss has made our words of condolences meaningless to our ears. He says, think also of words you want to say to 70-year-old Rashid Muhammad, whose 44-year-old son Samir was executed with a single bullet to the heart in front of his wife and children. The Israeli army refused to let an ambulance pick up his corpse for 11 days, so his family had to wait for the assault to stop before they could bury him. Rashid had the excruciatingly painful experience of looking at, touching, kissing, and then burying the decomposed body of his son. Tell his family how to make sense of their harsh reality. Say something to make the children sleep, to ease the anguish in the father's heart, to help the wife understand why her husband had to be taken from her. And that's just, a couple of examples in the words of Haider Eid of, thousands of stories that are going on in Gaza now, just unbelievable experiences. One of the pictures that really affected me was that children went back to school for the first day yesterday, and many of them went to school in tents, because their schools were destroyed by the bombing. But there was one picture in particular of boys in a classroom, and almost every other desk there was an empty chair, and instead of a student sitting there, there was just a white card with the name of the child who had been killed. And it was just a shocking, shocking picture, just the haunting absence of those children. And I think that's what we try to show, the realities, as well as the analysis, so people can understand this, because they're not getting it on the mainstream media in this country.
Obviously not. On Israel, this was a question that I had started to formulate on the last time that you were going to be here, because it was very pertinent. And I looked at it today, and I thought, how interesting. And I was going to ask you about the 200 prisoners that Israel released in a goodwill effort. Now, this happened just before the attack on Gaza. And these 200 prisoners were released to Mahmoud Abbas, the president of Palestine, in a goodwill effort, as Ehud Olmert had declared that Gazians should not be allowed to live normal lives. Ivy Dichter believes punishment should be inflicted irrespective of the cost to the Palestinians, that Gaza would remain as it is and make life harder. Mia Shetrit has urged that Israel should decide on a neighborhood in Gaza and level it. Then they did. How is this goodwill? And how does this relate to the same kind of hypocrisy that we see from Israel on a daily basis?
Well, what we learned subsequently from the Israeli media is that the Israelis had deliberately worked to give the impression that they were going to renew the ceasefire. They had allowed a trickle of humanitarian aid to into Gaza in the days before the attack to kind of put people at ease, while they were planning this massive surprise attack. So there was a deliberate effort. And this is what, you know, Israeli military officials were boasting about in their own press about, you know, aha, we really got them. You know, we let in humanitarian aid, we released the prisoners so that they would not think we were going to do this. And, I mean, the whole thing was a deception. You know, the narrative that has been repeated ad nauseum in the media here is that, you know, Israel was responding to surprise to these unprovoked missile attacks on its civilians, and unfortunately, the new Obama administration has swallowed that narrative lock, stock, and barrel. Of course, the reality was that there had been, as the Israelis themselves admitted, there had been a ceasefire from June 19th, which Israel and Hamas agreed to, and which Hamas abided by. And that ceasefire collapsed on November 4th when Israel carried out an attack in the Gaza Strip, killing six Palestinians. And it turns out that that was deliberately provoked. The other aspect that is not talked about here is the siege and the blockade. The fact that Israel has been waging for almost 2 years what is in effect a silent war against 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza by besieging them and blockading them, not allowing food and medicine in. I mean, this isn't just cruel, it's murderous, because, you know, according to independent Palestinian public health organizations, over 200 Palestinians, 262, had died in the months before Israel began its attack, because they couldn't get chemotherapy drugs, because Israel wasn't allowing in spare parts for dialysis machines, because surgical supplies weren't coming in. So this was a silent war. And, you know, a blockade of this kind is considered an act of war. And yet nobody talks about, do Palestinians have a right to self-defense? But we talk about the aggressor's right to self-defense. It's really backwards.
You know, tonight I was listening to a lawyer, her name, Nisana Lichner, or something, I believe that was the name. Now this particular lawyer is an Israeli lawyer who is currently actively pursuing the financial reward of suing terrorists. One of the things that I found interesting was her statement that said, we are not responsible for Gaza. All we have to do is close the borders. Israel should be responsible. But at the same time, when the Gazians broke through the barricade to get through to Israel in order to get supplies, because they were being starved and besieged by this unbelievable denying them of the basic human rights, the American and Israeli government together decided that they were going to tell Hosni Mubarak that if he didn't close the border, that they would be stopping any funding to Egypt. So here we have the Israelis that tell us, on one hand, we're not responsible for them, we're going to... Do you see this as a forcing them into Egypt just to eliminate them from the territories?
Well, we have to talk a little bit about the context? I mean, who are the people in Gaza, and why is Israel doing this to them? I mean, that's a really important question that is just never talked about. I mean, the 1.5 million Palestinians in Gaza, you know, they often get referred to as Gazans. That is a mistake. They're mostly not Gazans. The 80% of them are refugees, Palestinian refugees from towns and villages that are now inside Israel. They or their, you know, their parents or grandparents were ethnically cleansed from what is now Israel in 1948 or in 1967. And they, in the Gaza Strip, they're not allowed to return to their homes for one reason only, which is that, you know, Israel purports to be a Jewish state, which means that it discriminates. If you're born in the country, like many of the Palestinian refugees, or their, you know, their parents and grandparents are born in the country, but now they're living in Gaza, they're not allowed to return home because they're the wrong religion. Now, if they were the wrong skin color, we would understand exactly what that was. We would call it racism, we would call it apartheid, and we would not shy away from that. But somehow, it's considered respectable for Israel to say, look, we're a Jewish state. So, you know, if you were born here and you got kicked out, you got ethnically cleansed, tough luck. Meanwhile, you know, Jewish people from anywhere in the world are allowed to go and move there and live there. So why? So Israel's problem, though, is really a fundamental one, which is that the population in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza Strip, the Jewish proportion of the population has been falling in recent years, and the Palestinian proportion has been rising to the point now where they're at parity. There's just over 5 million Israeli Jews and just over 5 million Palestinians. And Palestinians are growing rapidly, and so this is a real problem for Israel because, you know, when you have a state that is ruled by one minority group, you have an apartheid state. I mean, it already is apartheid, but, you know, it becomes more visible to the rest of the world. So Israel needed to conceal this reality, which is how they came up with the idea of the so-called disengagement from Gaza, which was basically, let's take the settlers out. This was back in 2005. There were 8,000 Israeli settlers there. And then we can say that we are now no longer responsible for the Gaza Strip. Those 1.5 million Palestinians, not on our books, they belong to someone else, and we have magically subtracted 1.5 million Palestinians from the population tables. Of course, the reality was that Israel didn't withdraw from the Gaza Strip. It just moved the occupation to the edges, so that you basically turned Gaza into this giant prison, a dumping ground for unwanted human beings. And in my book, One Country, I actually quote one of the planners of this scheme, a guy called Arnon Sofer, who said, you know, this isn't going to create peace. We know it's not going to create peace. What it's going to do is just, you know, cage the Palestinians in, and, you know, we're just going to have to bomb them every time they try and resist us. Every time they raise a fuss, we'll just bomb them. So they get the message that, you know, that either they stay quiet or they leave. And he actually says it. It's all in my book and fully documented. Arnon Sofer, one of the architects of this plan. And we now see that. And that interview with him that I quote, which was in 2004 in the Jerusalem Post, we see that playing out exactly now in Gaza. All this talk about rockets, you know, the rockets is like weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. They, you know, the rockets do exist, but they are a distraction, and they are just the excuse. It's really about something else.
Well, first of all, I stand corrected because I have many times been guilty of calling them Gazans, and you're absolutely right. They're Palestinians that have been.
Some of them are Gazans because, you know, this is important that Gaza itself has, you know, a rich culture and tradition and history which has just been systematically destroyed. You know, there are Palestinians, there's a rich tradition of a maritime tradition, the fishermen, of course, who are now prevented from going out to sea by the Israeli naval blockade. There are Christians in Gaza. It's often misrepresented as this kind of fanatical religious place, but there are Christian communities there who are suffering exactly the same as all the other Palestinians. So, I mean, there's so much of the human richness, just the humanity of people there, that is so obscured in the demonization that is used in order to justify, you know, starving and killing people. You know, the first step to killing people is dehumanizing them, and that has been so systematic.
It absolutely has, and you know, that's what brings me to your book, Ali. I'm glad you mentioned it. Ali wrote a book called One Country, and it is a bold proposal to end the Israeli-Palestinian impasse. And part of what you're suggesting is a one-state solution, Ali. I would like to touch briefly on that because I am in favor also of a one-state solution, although I think from my position, as many times as I've tried to analyze the situation, I cannot see that ever being a possibility for a variety of reasons. Because the fact that a pseudo-theocracy and not a democracy exists in Israel, because of the very nature of what it is that they want. It isn't a matter of, and you know, it would be luxurious of us to say that, well, they only hate the Palestinians. I think it didn't matter who was there. It mattered that they wanted the land, and we just happened to be the people in the way, and they had to get rid of us. So how do we come to a one-state solution in light of what has happened over the last few months?
Right. Well, over the last 60 years, this is the latest episode in a long struggle and a long history of violence. Well, I mean, you know, to try and do this as simply and clearly as possible, you know, what has failed is the so-called two-state solution. You know, the only way you could have a Jewish state in Palestine, I mean, Jews were not a majority in Palestine. They were a minority when Israel was created. Palestinians, Arabs, who were Muslims and Christians, and indeed Jews, because there was always an indigenous Palestinian Jewish community, were the vast majority of the people. And they understandably, I mean, if you come to a group of people and say, look, you know, we're going to establish a state for ourselves, and it's a Jewish state, and the majority is not Jewish, logically, how are they going to react? They're not going to say, okay, well, we'll just leave, and you take our place. So the demand to create a Jewish state by the Jewish minority, most of them recently arrived immigrants, could only be fulfilled by the forced displacement of the Palestinian people. And so Israel as a Jewish state has been maintained through, created through ethnic cleansing and maintained through violence, maintained through the constant violence needed to stop Palestinians returning home, to stop them from exercising self-determination in their own land. And the amounts of violence needed to maintain the artificial Jewish majority in Palestine have been escalating. And we see the consequences of that in Gaza. So a two-state solution is unviable. There's no way to partition Palestine in a way that any bare majority of Palestinians or any bare majority of Israelis would accept. So what can we do? Well, I would say to you that it's not what Israelis want is not a state of their own. What they want is exactly what whites in South Africa wanted, exactly what whites in the south of the United States wanted. They want to preserve their power and privilege, and that's what they don't want to give up. And, you know, and the same in Northern Ireland. You had Protestant unionists who did not want to give up their power and their privileges. And they fought to keep it. And so, you know, all of those groups, if you'd gone down to, you know, Mississippi or Georgia in the 1940s or 1950s and said, you know, what are the chances that white people are going to give up power and agree to, you know, have equal rights with African Americans? And I'm sure that, you know, 80-90% of whites would have said no way. So, you know, those kinds of views are not unusual in these kinds of situations. So how does it change? First of all, there has to be a demand coming from the ground. You know, people will not accept to be dehumanized. Palestinians, like African Americans, like black South Africans, like Catholic nationalists in Northern Ireland, they believe that they're fully human. They believe they should have equal rights, and so they fight for it. The other side of it, and this is what I try to do in the book, is you have to begin to lay out a vision for what society looks like, a better society, a transformed society, based on equality, based on full participation of everyone. But you don't get there just because you ask nicely. There has to be a struggle, like there was against apartheid in South Africa, like there was a civil rights struggle in Northern Ireland. And in both cases, people in the United States played a crucial role. It took the Irish-American community lobbying and being active until American companies doing business in Northern Ireland refused to do business with companies that did not have equality in the workplace between Catholic nationalists and Protestants. And so that was a very important intervention. With South Africa, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement was a very important intervention in saying to white South Africans, you know, you cannot just enjoy the status quo and a normal life while you do such, you know, you allow people to suffer so much. And so that's what Palestinians are now saying to the world, that, you know, we don't want violence. If you don't want to see violence, provide an alternative. Step in with boycott, divestment, and sanctions and put pressure on Israel till they decide, like whites in South Africa, that the time for change has come. And I think that people are starting to really hear that message. And that's what will change things, and you'll be surprised how fast it can change things.
Well, I absolutely agree with you, but are the divestments, the sanctions, and any of those things really being pushed hard enough to make a real impact on Israel, Ani?
Well, I think so. I think that one of the amazing things is that, you know, in hindsight, history looks rosy. The first time South Africans called for boycott, divestment, and sanctions was in 1958. It took until the 1980s for that movement to really take off. Until the 1980s, Western companies, Western governments were doing business with South Africa. Sports teams were going over there. Performers were going over there. It took more than 20 years. The first call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions from Palestinian civil society, and this came from, you know, a coalition of hundreds of Palestinian civil society organizations, came in 2005. And in the 3 years since that call, this movement has moved further than the South African anti-apartheid movement did in its first 15 years. So progress is being made, and it's more advanced in Europe and Canada, New Zealand, Australia, where trade unions, academic unions are starting to, this is really starting to take off. But even here in the United States, it's really starting to begin to get noticed, especially on campuses. And I'd say it's not just boycott, divestment, and sanctions, but also justice, international justice, where we use universal jurisdiction laws to bring to justice Israeli war criminals, those accused of these massive war crimes in Gaza. And Israel is so worried about that that their military censor has made it illegal in Israel to publish the name or image of any Israeli military officer who was involved in Gaza, because they don't want to help prosecutors to gather evidence for these war crimes trials. So they're worried enough that this is a real prospect. That's a good sign.
Well, you know, we're going to have to take a break right now. This is very interesting. Actually, I can understand some of it. I just and I'm glad. I agree that we certainly have come a lot further and a lot faster than the apartheid in South Africa. And one of the things that I found interesting, and this is something I think a lot of people don't know, Ali, is that Israel actually supported the South Africa apartheid. They fought against any kind of freedom for the indigenous people there. And I just found that to be, you know, just absolutely just unbelievable. They armed them, and they armed them with water cannons, didn't they?
Well, more than that. In fact, there was an international arms embargo in South Africa, and the entire South African Air Force that they were using to bomb ANC headquarters in different African countries and the South African Navy were basically supplied by Israel. And, of course, they cooperated on creating a nuclear bomb together.
Unbelievable. I mean, it's unbelievable. And so many of the people here in the United States that have so staunchly fought for rights based on color have been supporters of the Israeli government. And it's just, the hypocrisy behind that is unbelievable.
Well, it's a lot of ignorance as well, because the Israelis have done a really good job of not just misinforming people, but intimidating people so that, you know, if you even ask these questions, you'll be accused of being an anti-Semite or a racist. And so I think we have to start to break that and, you know, say to people, it's okay to ask questions about Israel. Israel is not God. Israel is just a country, you know, and any country in the world has to be open to criticism and, scrutiny.
Well, I absolutely agree. One of the things, now, and we know with Reverend Wright under the Obama issue, we had that very thing. He was threatened. He was told that Reverend Wright was a racist, an anti-Semite, and that
a lot of it was because of his criticism of Israel. And that hasn't come out in the mainstream press. You know, they made it about his comments about, you know, damn America and all that. But what the Israel lobby were really upset about, and they called for Obama to break relations with Wright months before he actually did so, was because Wright, as a matter of principle, had opposed apartheid in South Africa and opposed apartheid in Israel, and that's what they were really upset about.
Unbelievable. We have some callers on the line. Our first caller, please give us your name and your question for Ali.
My name is Nela, and I'm from the...
Hi.
First of all, sir, bear with my accent. I talk slowly, okay? I'm very stunned in this whole situation and tragedy, how the Arab nations around Palestine react. I don't see that much of a response as neighbor countries. Do you know anything on this? Are they willing to politically help the Palestine people or not? I know from the Western world there is barely no help, and I understand this, but the surrounding Arab countries, for such a tragedy and for such a massacre and murdering, they are very silent.
Yes. What a great question. I mean, we have to distinguish between the Arab governments and the Arab peoples, because there has been an unprecedented response among Arab people. We've seen marches of millions of people from Morocco, you know, all the way to Indonesia, so not just Arab, but Muslim and non-Muslim. I mean, in Turkey, you had hundreds of thousands of people coming out into the streets in Istanbul. In Europe, you know, you had tens of thousands. And this is despite the media censorship, despite that the governments have all taken Israel's side. Now, the governments, the Arab governments, it's a different story. So many of these governments surrounding Palestine are client states of the United States, and they have basically sided with Israel and the United States. But this is not at all representative of what the people want. And Egypt in particular has been really complicit in the siege of Gaza and in really allowing Israel to carry out this war. And that's because these regimes themselves are very undemocratic. They are very much afraid of mass movements like Hamas, which, you know, represent you know, the will of the people who live there, and they want, you know, they, like Israel, would like to see Hamas and any kind of resistance to their power destroyed. But they are really on the back foot now. You know, the weapons that they're using, I'm not going to tell you that Hamas never made any kind of mistake, but so much of what you hear is deliberate demonization. It's the kind of strategy that was used against Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland to say, you know, these are fanatics, there's no way you can talk to them. It's the same strategy that was used to demonize the African National Congress. You know, Nelson Mandela still has difficulties getting visas to the United States because the ANC was labeled a terrorist organization. So all those tactics are being used because these regimes, the Arab regimes, are very much terrified of mass movements and liberation struggles.
You know, we have a great question here. Debs asks, and she's letting me know where she is, I do my best to inform, she's from Massachusetts, I do my best to inform Americans about the Palestinian suffering by Israel, but I'm only one person and limited. Do you have any suggestions on how to educate Americans on a wide scale? Some Americans don't even know where Israel and where Palestine and Israel is. Thank you, Debs, for that question.
Yeah, that's a question I get all the time, and it's one I, of course, struggle with because I'm trying to do the same thing. And, you know, I think we can often feel very isolated by ourselves because we think, you know, I'm just one person. But one of the things that strikes me all the time is that, you know, I'm very lucky. I get to travel around the country a lot. I get invited to go and speak. So I meet so many people. I don't think there's a corner of this country where there aren't like-minded people who aren't doing this work. And I think our challenge is to connect to each other better and kind of to support each other better. But I also feel that there have been tremendous breakthroughs, that people are losing that fear of questioning. They're losing the sense that they're going to be, you know, maligned or slandered, that they're anti-Semitic just because they care about human rights. I mean, we're being told that if you care about human rights, that makes you a hateful anti-Semitic person. And people are no longer, those kinds of intimidation tactics aren't working so well. You know, this was discussed on The Daily Show last night. Jimmy Carter was on. They were talking about a one-state solution. On Sunday, Bob Simon on 60 Minutes was talking about how in the West Bank it's apartheid. So this is very mainstream media starting to wake up to the reality. And I think a large part of the credit goes to people like Debs who have been doing this work year after year, day in, day out, even when they felt no one wanted to listen. And I think we have to keep it up. And I'm very hopeful that it can make a difference. The electronic intifada is there as a resource, but that's our response. That's what we did to try and break through this silence. And, you know, every day we're getting new readers. So I don't have all the answers, but I look around, and people are doing this in incredibly creative ways of how to reach people through nonviolent direct action, through meeting with editorial boards, through meeting with elected representatives. I think all those activities have to continue. And, of course, people starting to join up and say, you know, what is boycott, divestment, and sanctions? So if you want to find out more about that, go to bdsmovement.net and, you know, just read about it, see what people are doing and how you can start to get involved in that.
Well, thank you. And, you know, Debs, just keep doing what you're doing. This is why we started the People Speak, because we believe here when the people speak, they make a difference. Mark from Ohio is on the line with us. Mark, can you give us your question for Ali, please?
Yes, excellent show. My question for the guest is, I've been reading that 70,000 Iranians volunteered to aid the Gazans. I've read that Russia is building a naval base in Syria and aiding Lebanon. What are the chances of this conflict during Barack Obama's administration expanding into drawing in other countries?
Well, I think in some extent it's already a regional conflict, because some of what is going on in Gaza is not just about Palestine. It's about, you know, the U.S. trying to maintain. I mean, really the bigger confrontation in the region is that the United States is a global power, a global empire, and its hegemony, its control of the region is under threat, because there are people and movements there who say, we don't want to be controlled by the United States. You may not like how we design our governments, but we want to design them by ourselves. We don't want to be told what, you know, what to do and how to run ourselves. I think that's perfectly legitimate. You know, when the United States declared independence, it declared independence so it could have slavery. And it took a while before we figured out that wasn't such a great thing. But, you know, nobody is trying to have slavery over there. It's just an example to say that you can't really control people's destinies. So that's really the struggle. And the United States has kind of set up this narrative where it calls the countries that, you know, its own client states, the so-called moderates, and everyone who says, you know, leave us alone, they call an extremist. And, you know, Iran is kind of what we call the head of the extremist bloc. But Iran is a country like any other. We can talk to them. Conflict is not inevitable. You know, Ronald Reagan, who, you know, is this conservative hero in this country, talked to the Soviet Union and negotiated with them. George Bush made a deal with North Korea. There's nothing that says you can't talk to Iran, and this constant militarism of ours where we, you know, if you don't do what we want, we'll go to war against you, has to end. It has to end. War is not inevitable. But what worries me is that so far, you know, we're only a week in, the new administration, as far as Palestine is concerned, has continued the same policies of the Bush administration unchanged, and that is very dangerous.
Thank you. Hassan, Ali, I'd like to ask you a really important question, I think. How do you feel about the statements that President Obama has made in his apparent selling out of the Palestinians to gain the favor of the Israeli government, not only during his campaign, his long and arduous campaign, but his first choice of cabinet member, Rahm Emanuel, the son of a well-known terrorist, Benjamin Emanuel. He was a member of the infamous Ergun game. As a matter of fact, even his name Rahm was a surname given to him in memory of another terrorist from yet another infamous Israeli terror group, the Lehi. How does this kind of a person benefit the Palestinians in the so-called pursuit of peace between Israel and Palestine?
Well, you know, I've been watching Barack Obama's political career for 10 years because he was my state senator, actually more than 10 years. He was my state senator in Illinois when none of the rest of you had heard about him. And I met him on a number of occasions. We weren't close friends or anything like that, but I did know him and met him. And, you know, his kind of, as he set his aspirations higher and higher, and it was clear that he was very ambitious from the start, you know, he realized, you know, where the power is right now in this country, where the campaign money is with a lot of people who are very pro-Israel. And he made that decision very early on that he wasn't going to, you know, rock any boats there. And the reality is he hasn't. What's remarkable is how, you know, despite his very clear record, which has been very pro-Israel, consistently in public, in private he was a little more conciliatory and nuanced, but in public, despite that, people have been, you know, had these very high expectations. But he comes into office, and within 2 days, he reaffirms all the same Bush administration policies. So, you know, we only talk about Palestinian violence. We don't talk about the much more massive Israeli violence, which is being done with our weapons and our aid in violation of American law. We don't talk to the elected representatives of the Palestinians. We support the blockade of Gaza. I mean, you cannot find a hair's breadth of difference between Obama and Bush. And in fact, Hillary Clinton today came out and gave her full endorsement to Israel's attacks on the Gaza Strip. So, you know, I think that, that we have to realize that change does come from the top, and I think a lot of people allowed themselves to kind of just be taken in by the sort of atmospherics of the campaign and lose sight that, that there's a lot of hard work to be done.
Julie in Arkansas asks an interesting question. Is Barack Obama a Zionist, and how has he changed since you knew him 10 years ago?
I don't know if he's a Zionist. In other words, I don't know if when he says, you know, he believes Israel should be a Jewish state, if he actually sincerely believes that. The only thing I can judge are his actions. And his actions have been very consistent with, you know, all recent U.S. administrations, which is unconditional support for Israel. You know, on the few occasions when I had discussions with him about these issues, and others that I know who talked to him more frequently, he was much more nuanced in his understanding. But I don't judge him by that. I judge him by what he's done. And I think it's foolhardy to sort of say, well, you know, somewhere deep down in his heart, he knows better. He may well know better, but a lot of politicians know better. We have to judge them by what they do and hold them accountable by what they do. And he, you know, is exactly the same. He's a human being and he's a politician. He is not a magician and he's not a prophet.
You know, there's been a huge protest and an outcry against the BBC in England, Ali, and one of the things that I found to be quite interesting in relation to any funds that are going to be sent to Gaza for humanitarian relief, Israel has put a lot of pressure on the BBC not to air the broadcast, claiming that they don't know where this money would be going, that it could possibly be getting to terrorist organizations and Hamas. Go ahead. There really isn't a whole lot to say beyond that.
There's a couple of things. I mean, first of all, the background for the listeners is what happened with the BBC is that in the UK, all the major charities, the best-known brand-name charities, let's call them Oxfam, Christian Aid, Save the Children, the Red Cross, all the big charities in the UK, they have a procedure where whenever there's a major humanitarian disaster anywhere in the world, they get together, they have something called the Disasters Emergency Committee, and they put together an appeal, a humanitarian appeal that says, you know, people need food and water or medicine or whatever it is, please give. And this is all managed by these top well-known charities. And traditionally, the broadcasters, the BBC, the national broadcaster, the others, put it on air, no questions asked. For the first time in history, the BBC refused to do that. The other broadcasters agreed to do it, except for Rupert Murdoch's Sky News. Rupert Murdoch, of course, is the owner of Fox, so a very right-wing station. And they said, well, this would harm our impartiality. You know, people would see us as biased. And what's amazing is this has created an unprecedented uproar in the UK. So you've had tens of thousands, literally, last time I checked, 21,000 complaints against the BBC from viewers, and 300 of them supported the BBC's position that it would be biased to say, you know, there are children in need of medicine and clean water, and we should help them. We're not asking you to judge why they're in need. We're just saying these children are in need and they need your help. And the government has come out, and churches, religious leaders, but the BBC hasn't budged. And what's amazing is that the BBC, which for me growing up and for many people was kind of the standard, has fallen so far. And I think it's a victim of the kind of political pressure that pro-Israel groups have invested in putting pressure on broadcasters and the media. But the good news of the story is that everybody saw through it. And the appeal, despite the fact that the BBC censored it and refused to show it, has already raised millions of dollars. And there's even a group of lawyers who are planning to sue the BBC, and they're saying, you know, that this is racial discrimination. You know, you've broadcast every other appeal through history. Why are you taking this anti-Palestinian position that they're the only group of people who don't deserve humanitarian aid?
Well, you know, one of the things that I found interesting, we had last week on our show Greta Berlin of the Free Gaza. Cynthia McKinney happened to call in, and one of the things that she told us and our listeners was on the humanitarian boat, the Dignity, as they were being rammed, a CNN reporter out of Britain who was on the ship itself was actually arguing with CNN because they wanted to put the lie, they wanted to put the Israeli version as opposed to the truth as
which
he was
filmed.
Presenting, which he was, he was a victim of. And
yeah.
I thought that was just amazing.
Yeah.
How do we fight such corruption, Holly? How is this still acceptable in 2009?
Well, you know, it's not acceptable, and I don't have a magic bullet, but I think that no great social change has come without people demanding it and struggling for it, and that's the long road, and I've been on it for most of my life, and I feel that things are changing, I really do, and I think we just have to continue on that long road. You know, I think a lot of people woke up in these past few weeks when they saw that Israel had banned international journalists from entering Gaza. And the only source of information Israel wanted us to have is what the Israeli military spokesperson said. But I think, things have changed. They were not able to control the information anymore because people in Gaza were getting the information out. Electronic Intifada was one of it, but, you know, people were blogging. People were using Skype. There were people from the international solidarity movement and the Free Gaza movement on the ground. And you had Al Jazeera, which broadcasts in English and Arabic free on the internet. And so they could not control the information anymore. And that is the good news here.
And, you know, there's one other thing that I just have to ask you and pick your brain about. And this is something that I have a personal issue with. Obviously, earlier you had addressed with one of our callers the issue of the differentiation between the people calling out against this atrocity in Gaza and the leaders not calling out.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Hosni Mubarak and the Arab leaders and why they waited so long to demand the cessation of the genocide of the citizens of Gaza?
Well, why they waited so long is because they supported it, and Egypt in particular. You know, it's a repeat of what happened in Lebanon in 2006. Like Israel, these regimes are, you know, undemocratic. They don't have the consent of the people who live under them. And, of course, you know, there's more than 5 million Palestinians who live under the Israeli regime who have no say in it. And, you know, in Egypt you have tens of millions of people who have no say in their own fate and their future. Unfortunately, these undemocratic regimes are the ones allied to the United States that we call, you know, so-called moderates. So they want to get rid of these mass movements like Hezbollah and Hamas, so they demonize them, they misrepresent them, and they want to, you know, they effectively wanted to destroy them. So they were hoping that Hamas would be destroyed, just like they hoped Hezbollah would be destroyed. But it's a miscalculation, because movements like this, like Sinn Féin, you know, the problem is people believe their own propaganda. They saw it's just a group of terrorists, a little gang, and they don't realize these are mass movements, as Sinn Féin was in Northern Ireland, as, you know, the ANC was in South Africa. You can't bomb your way out of these situations. You have to start dealing with them. Hamas was elected. Like it or hate it, they were elected. And you know what? You don't get to choose your enemy's leaders. If you want peace, you have to talk. You know, Palestinians, believe me, if they could choose Israel's leaders, they would not choose the bunch of war criminals who are there now. But that's who the Israeli people have picked. You have to deal with it. And that's the kind of reality-based policy that we need to move towards.
Well, this is something that I've always found humorous. Every time they, one of the leaders said that they wouldn't deal with the Palestinians or the Palestinian leadership or the authority or Arafat or Hamas and, you know, on and on and on. I always laughed. I says, okay, let's go talk to the Irish about it.
Yeah, I mean, this is the amazing thing is that you have a... No, I mean, imagine, you know, put it in simple terms. Imagine you have a dispute with your next-door neighbor. You have a serious dispute with him over, no, I don't know what. And instead of talking to him about it, you go and talk to the guy down the street who hates him about it. I mean, what sense does that make? You know, it makes no sense. It is a failed policy. You know, the British demonized Sinn Féin for decades. The South Africans demonized the ANC for decades. In this country, we demonize civil rights people. We set dogs on them and fire hoses, and churches were bombed with little girls in them. But eventually, you know what? Civil rights came. And, you know, one of the tactics of people in power, when they are challenged by those who are marginalized and those who are dispossessed, the first thing they do is they demonize them. When women demanded equality in the vote, they were demonized. The first women who stood up and said, you know, we want a full say in this society, they were subjected to the same kind of demonization. Native people in this country, you know, 120 years ago, the newspapers would have been full of stories about, you know, Indian, what we would call today, terrorists. And that was a way to legitimize taking their land. So we have to recognize that these tactics are used again and again. And whenever we, as individuals, start to hear ourselves thinking, you know, that group of people deserve what they get, stop yourself and say, wait a minute, I am falling for something here. I'm allowing a group of people to be dehumanized so that they can be treated unjustly or worse. And that's the mentality we really have to fight against.
Hear, hear. Thank you very much, Ali. Ali Abunama of the Electronic Intifada, founder and journalist. We appreciate your work. Thank you, brother, and God bless you, and keep up the good work for
Thank
Palestine.
You. I can't believe that was an hour.
I know. It always happens that way, Ali. It goes by so quickly. And perhaps one day we can count on you to come back again.
I would love to. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. And ladies and gentlemen, next week, Tuesday, we have Hassan Nawash, of the Palestinian, founder of the Palestinian Office. Thank you very much. And you all have a great evening. And remember, when the people speak, we make a difference. Thank you, Ali, and have a great evening.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of death, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.